is the Oregon Common Credentialing Program Rules Advisory Committee, meeting 1, May 3rd, 2017.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa of the Warren Oregon Health Authority. We just transitioned from our subject matter expert work group to our Rules Advisory Committee. So this is now a public meeting. Folks that previously joined will be going around the room and over the phone, on the phone again to make sure we have accounted for everyone's attendance in our write-up. And I do want to stress, though, today is a one-hour RAC meeting, and that is very quick in rulemaking terms, so we will have additional meetings, but we wanted to share with you our draft and what we may have for what we do have for placeholders, get some initial thoughts and input from you all, and then we can bring back a revised draft for you in the next few weeks. Luke, do you have information on the doodle poll?
I do. So we have two out for the second and third meeting. I know a number of you have completed that. Thank you. If not, I sent it out with the attended materials in that email. So if you could complete that this week, that would be great. We can get everything scheduled by the end of the week.
Okay, so we'll go around the room. I'll start with you, Rebecca.
Sure.
Identify who you are and who you're with.
Great. I'm Rebecca Pavlock. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals.
Hillary Parks, Mother Health Credentialing Supervisor.
Amy Lyons, Legacy Health.
Shannon Jones, Willamette Dental Group.
Ann Klinger, Providence Health.
Amy Rothman, HealthShare.
Mark Bonanno, Oregon Medical Association.
Nicole Krishnaswamy, Oregon Medical Board.
Alison Villa, OHA,
Luke Glossy, OHA, Business Analyst on the Common Credentialing Program.
And on the phone?
Health and Quality.
Mary Pullman, Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah, Melanie and Mary.
Hello. Catherine Sim, Campus St. Charles Health System.
And yeah, Health and Quality.
Okay.
Melanie Cookman.
Central Oregon IPA.
Okay, you got Melanie, you got Jen.
Karen Dugan, also from Asante.
Okay, great.
Hattie Clabby from Regions.
Okay. Yep. You're all still there. Okay.
Jesse Johnson, University Medical Group, OHSU.
And Neil, is Neil still on?
And Neil's here too, yes, he is.
Okay, any others? This is again a line that participants are muted until our testimony public comments section, which will be the last 10 minutes or so. We'll open up the phone lines then. Okay. So, did you want to go through the rule timeline at all, Luke?
You can actually. We'll find to someone who can't fit on the rule. Okay.
Trying to make other people talk. So we have this lovely rulemaking timeline in your packet, and it's just really identifying the process that we have to work through and why we're starting this process now. We don't have finalized fees approved by the legislature at this time. We intend to have that by the end of June or July, so we cannot place that into the rule or finalize our rules until then, but we do need to make sure that we can communicate our program, and that in statute really says that we have to do that through our rules as well, at least 6 months in advance of going live. So if we had an operational date, and we're anticipating early 2018, if we had an operational date of April 1st, we would really have to have our rules published by October 1st. And there's really a 45-day process for rulemaking with the state. So you have to submit your notice of proposed rule, conduct a hearing a few weeks later, and then you make changes and publish your final rule. So there's this 45-day process really that we have to account for. So what we want to do is file our rules by mid-July, and that's what you'll see here, 7/14 date. The program will provide the rules coordinator with a draft rule, list of interested parties, and all filing documents for the Secretary of State. So a few days later, that coordinator will notify all legislators and file the documents with the Secretary of State. And a few weeks later, there will actually be a publication for the Secretary of State bulletin will be published August 1st. So as long as we get our rules in by mid-July, it'll hit the August 1st one. And so then from there, there's a two-week period until the hearing. The hearing will be a public hearing. So we come, we talk about the rules, and we allow folks to provide comments on the rules. So it's another public process that we record, and so we have to go through that. And then we will then file our final document by the end of September is what we anticipate, and shortly thereafter it is published and finalized. Is that clear? It's always a fun process these days. Yes, Nicole.
Just really technical. My deadline, I'm a rule coordinator for the medical board, and our deadline is before the 15th to get it published on the 1st of the next month.
Right.
So it has to be in on July 14th instead of July 17th.
Oh, okay.
Because the 15th is a Saturday, so it would be the Friday before.
Right.
In order to make that 8-1 bulletin.
Okay, so that's where we had put the 7/14. So our rules coordinator didn't see this document.
Okay,
so
yeah, it would just need
so
to
she
be
probably would have flagged that.
Filed online with them by the 14th.
I thought filing with her would be enough, right? The actual
never
Secretary
enough.
Of State one.
And
thank
then
you.
Are you going to keep the comment period then open for 21 days after it's published? So you would still have to accept written comments up until at least August 21st, which is not on the timeline, but
we can put the public comment period. I know there's a public comment period past the hearing that we usually allow, so
yeah, it has to be 21 days after it's published.
Okay. Great. We can incorporate that into this so it's clear. There will be, there's a section on our website now that identifies the rulemaking components of this and the meeting, so we can just revise this and post it up there so folks know. Thank you. Okay. So with that, we left. Time we open these rules up, we developed the rules for this. They're attached to telemedicine credentialing rules. Some of you may have had a hand in that. So those are opening up with this rule as well. It's all part of the credentialing rules under OHA. So I just wanted to point that out. Last time we used this same group, although there were a little bit different participants than there were before. This is the group where a lot of the details come out of. We will work on these rules this month, so we'll have this meeting and then we'll have a second two-hour meeting, which Luke said we're doing a doodle poll for, so it'll be scheduled shortly. And then once we have that draft, we'll go to the advisory group and get their input on what we've done with the rules. And then we'll come back to you one more time after that meeting with kind of like the finalized input before we hit the Secretary of State. Did someone just join that's a SME member?
Yeah, this is Tricia from Pacific Source. I was on the last meeting too.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So that's how this is all going to go down. And if anybody has any questions, we can address them now and otherwise go right into the rules. Okay, we'll go right into the rule. So, we have a rule draft for you, and I mentioned this earlier, an hour ago. So those of you that weren't here, this is a tight time frame in order to go through rules. but this is our first hour. We will have two additional meetings, again, in a couple of weeks, and then, as I said, next month we'll have one after we meet with the advisory group for common credentialing. What we've done in here is we have made some changes based on conversations and issues that have come up in the last few years and some clarifications. We actually have Senate Bill 604 put into statute now as of last year. So finally, we have some statutory number references that we could put in here. So we did that, and some areas there are placeholders. In some areas, we need still DOJ opinions and a little bit more information. How we put the fees into the rules is actually a little bit questionable. Nicole, you actually might have some input on this since you guys do fees for your organization. So that'll be good to go through with you. So I think I just wanted to go through section by section and identify changes. General structure of these rules is we have our definitions. We have then requirements for participants, so healthcare practitioners, boards, and the healthcare regulatory boards, and credentialing organizations. There's a component for the organ practitioner credentialing application, the OPCA. We had rules in there before. We had adjusted them a few years back. We may want to do a few more adjustments. I don't know, so be thinking about that. Then we have some use of information issues in here. We have advisory group rules in here, and the imposition of fees. Then we get into telemedicine providers. I made some draft changes in there that we can look at. I'll explain those as we get to that, but a lot of that may change because everyone will have access to the system, so there's not really this need for delegating the collection and verification of information to other organizations if it's available in the system for you and you're paying for it and you're already in there. So be thinking about that. Okay. In terms of definition, the first red mark you'll see in there is just formatting changes, really. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about whether to change anything in credentialing organization. I will say we're doing a little bit more work in this. Again, we have the 300 organizations we intend to enter into the system once we go live, but there may be others. The definition in statute is very broad. Credentialing organization means a hospital or healthcare facility, physician organization, or other healthcare provider organization, coordinated care organization, business organization, insurer, other organization that credentials healthcare practitioners. So that could be a whole slew of folks depending on how you define credentialing, which is another very broad definition. So really, when we developed this definition, we looked to legislative testimony for Senate Bill 604 and came out with these. It's actually six here, but it's seven. We lumped in hospitals and health systems on the same line. If you feel it's appropriate, we might want to actually separate those out. But we did have the language in here, this includes but is not limited to, so that we can add in as necessary, but these were the main guys. Any thoughts on that? Ooh, separate out hospitals and health systems? I'm saying yes. I think that sounds like a good idea. Okay. Hospital Association says, sure, okay. Okay. I would encourage you all to go over these definitions in detail and looking at delegated credentialing agreement. We have defined it as two separate things for for our general credentialing rules, and then there's a side note about telemedicine credentialing. So we may want to look at that collectively as a group. Delegated credentialing agreement means a written agreement between credentialing organizations that delegate the responsibility to perform specific activities related to the credentialing and recredentialing of healthcare practitioners. Fairly standard for us. For telemedicine credentialing, delegated credentialing agreement has the same meaning given that term, NORS 442015, and I forget what that is. I can take a look real quick, actually. But let's just table that to make sure we think about that definition.
Amy, were you a part of the legislative stuff for telemedicine?
I seem to recall.
We had a staff member, though.
Amanda Walker. No, that sounds familiar. Okay, maybe is that staff person still around in the same kind of role? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, just to make sure. And we didn't get Denal on the phone at all? Denal Everidge?
She's not. I talked to her today. She's got a conflict.
Oh, okay. So
I've done an audit. They just got audited today.
Okay. Well, I'll touch bases with her on the telemedicine, too, because she was a part of those rules. We did those in 2013. Okay. So, then we get to healthcare practitioner. Now, we have this wonderful list of 26, because of A to Z, practitioners. And this is another one that includes but is not limited to, because it's all healthcare practitioners that must be credentialed. Again, a broad definition. I threw in some practitioner types at the end of this list for us to consider. I think pharmacist is one that keeps coming up. It's something that we even talked to the Board of Pharmacy, and you and I were talking about it even today. But more and more pharmacists are being actually credentialed rather than just the facilities or whatnot. So it's a question of, do we have it in here as a commonly, this list was a list of commonly credentialed practitioners. It was vetted 8 different times with 3 different groups. So it was a hard list to come up with and negotiate with everyone. Pharmacist was not put on the list then because we only got word that one organization was credentialing pharmacists. But now as they're able to prescribe and hand out, smoking cessation, then birth control or contraceptive devices, whatever, it's becoming more of a need or a standard kind of nationwide. So what are your thoughts on pharmacists in particular?
I could put them on the list.
Okay, that's Providence. I see a few nods in the room.
Regents. I would say yes, Regents requires it, so for them to be credentialed.
Okay.
This is Melanie from Asante. We have a small amount of PharmDs that are that provide services in our ambulatory clinics, and some of the health plans do reimburse for that. So I don't know. I would think that if pharmacists were included in this list, that we would feel comfortable that the PharmDs were sort of covered under that.
Okay. But we'll add pharmacists to the list. Again, there will be a public hearing, and there's still time for folks to comment. We also have the advisory group. So anything we put in here will be looked over several times, I'm sure. If anybody can pronounce this, it just doesn't roll off my tongue. Polysomnographic technologist. I've heard that they are credentialed. We talked to the Health Licensing Authority. They seem to think that they're credentialed practitioners. Does anybody know that that's a true? Anybody on the phone?
Pacific Source doesn't credential them because they're not independent.
Okay. What about respiratory therapists?
Same thing for Pacific Source.
We don't. Generally working under someone that is credentialed then.
I used to work at a sleep lab, and typically the doctors have to order everything, and then the RTs and the RPSGTs just follow those orders. They don't do anything themselves, as far as I know.
Okay. And so the tattoo artist comes up. I'm still thinking no, because that's a very rarity. It's an includes, but it's not limited to. How do folks feel about that?
Well, this is Tony. I have a question on the top part where it says must be credentialed. I think it kind of implies that every health plan, hospital, payer who would credential all of these providers, these types, and that's not necessarily the case. So does that need to be revised in a way that it's only if you're eligible for that particular health plan, if they don't offer these? Where you might come in where some have pharmacists, some might have these ones, the other ones below. It just depends on if they're recognized by that entity, regardless of what you are.
That definition we cannot change. That's the statutory definition. So I know that that's specifically that language, but it's in the interpretation. So it's for which the individual must be credentialed. So if you're not requiring them to be credentialed on your panel, then they don't fit into that definition. But if they do for another organization, then yes, they have to go into the system. They're only required to go in if they have to be credentialed. So if they're only participating on your plan and they don't have to be credentialed, then they don't have to go into the system.
Yes. I think the word will be changing the language, though, because it talks about professions that must be credentialed rather than positions, I guess.
Yeah.
Specifically for pharmacists, because their services are required to be covered by, this is just from a health plan perspective, the services are required to be covered. I personally would like to stay away from credentialing those types of practitioners just for the sheer volume of practitioners. So the language, from my perspective, would be based on this, that not only are we covering them from, I think it was like House Bill 2028, but also that we are credentialing them as in-network providers and making them a part of our roster.
Okay. Mark,
this is Mark. I think the question on the phone, too, had to do with, you know, do you need almost a catch-all phrase with respect to the concept that the individual must be credentialed? Because standards do change and evolve, and reimbursement standards change and evolve as different types of licensees come online in terms of, you know, they can be independent and submit claims, et cetera. So is that contemplated here at all, some sort of catch-all, and anyone else and any other licensee in the state who must be credentialed?
Right, so that's why we included that language. This includes, but is not limited to, the following practitioner
type. So you
think
that takes care of that? Okay.
Yeah.
Rather than having an at the end or any other.
Right. Right. So those ones that are kind of a rarity, so like the tattoo artists, again, that's why we didn't include them before. Because they're like, we'll have that in the catch-all. If they're actually required to be credentialed by an organization, then yes, they have to come in here. And they fall in that includes but is not limited to.
I still think we need to look at the language because as it reads, it's an individual authorized to practice a profession, blah, 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 for which the individual must be credentialed. And some of those professions, not everybody needs to be credentialed. So it's kind of the opposite of the inclusive but limited to.
But it's anyone required to practice a profession for which the individual must be credentialed.
So you're saying that implies that a pharmacist, all pharmacists
are correct. Some of them need to be credentialed depending on where they work.
I'm gonna look to Mark here for your opinion on that. So it does say, I understand your point there, so it does say to practice a profession for which the individual must be credentialed. So that seems to...
It's referring to the profession as this includes.
I'm a pharmacist. Yeah. I practice a profession, but I don't practice a profession for which the individual must be credentialed. I may have a particular job that I have to be credentialed in order to do, but to be a pharmacist, I don't need to be credentialed.
Right. And so I would think you're not included because, yes, you're in that profession, so you're included in this definition, but as an individual, you are not.
These individuals may include but are not limited to the following.
Because that allows to include people like pharmacists or psychologists who need to be credentialed in their specific role, but their profession as a whole does not require credentialing.
Right, and it may get a little vague for the individual pharmacist, although if they're working, let's just say, they don't need to be credentialed and then a particular plan says they do, they would have to then jump into the pool, if you will, just for that particular plan. So they would still need to become part of the system.
Yeah. So I think this allows for that here in our definition.
Just
Nicole, do you have any thoughts? I'm looking for the lawyers in the room.
This bill was first introduced years ago. I read the definition like that. And my concern was that not every physician is credentialed. There are some who are cash only, don't work for a health system, and don't want to be put into this pot. And the way that the definition read to me in the bill, and now verbatim in rule, is that it doesn't matter. If you're in this profession, you need to participate in the program. I understand that that's not how it was interpreted to be, that it's only those who need to be credentialed need to actually go through with.
But does the word individual, doesn't that...
I think it can be interpreted either way. So I'm wondering if you need a second sentence there.
Yeah, it's just the split of the sentences, because this is could refer to either of those, the profession or the individual. It's just adding some language there, maybe adding at the end of it that says to the extent that individual must be credentialed. It's repetitive.
Right. So you could say, after the first statutory definition, then have a second sentence that says something like, these individuals may be licensed in the following categories. I don't know, something like, or credentialing organizations may credential following providers.
Okay, I can work with that. Yeah. I mean, we don't want to spend too much time on this, but I get your guys' point, and I can work on something for our draft. But it would be super awesome if you guys would think of something and help provide some language. So.
And maybe there's some language that would actually be in the MedPerson system.
Maybe.
Because if you're directed to fill something out by the state or somebody tells you to go there, but here you're in your own private practice.
Right.
Then you're thinking, okay, why am I doing this? I'm just going to do it. But if the list of credentialing organizations were in there, then that's how you would know. Mm-hmm. So I think there could be some clarity in the actual system itself to help that provider interpret and understand the intent of the
right.
Yes, certainly.
Yes. It's possible.
Because if they read this, yes. I do think it would be confusing.
Okay. Okay. So I'll think about that and then take anybody's ideas into consideration. Okay. Surgical technician. Those folks are now required to be licensed. Is that kind of the same thing, that they're not really considered independent?
I would say that from a hospital perspective, depending on what they do, because some surgical, like a surgical first assist, can be independent. They don't need to be licensed. Yeah. We have registered nurse first assist, but there's surgical first assist.
Oh, okay.
So there's a couple different levels, and they're referred to sometimes as surgical technicians too. So we let them, they are independent. We have a supervisor, but it's an unofficial, bound by licensure or anything else, bound on the hospital side based on privileging.
Mm-hmm. Is it something like the Joint Commission would require? They would be acting independently, and so yes.
I would say we are credentialing them.
Okay.
We are. That's kind of subject to interpretation, because some people think you can go through a different process for symptoms, but because they're acting independently, we believe that they need to be credentialed.
Danielle, do you have anything?
Privilege, so we credential and privilege first surgical assistants. I put them in there. Certain categories, Joint Commission says, you know, that's up to your organization. You either have to choose, they all go HR way or they all go the medical staff way. So there could be some organizations that do it one way versus another way, but we do privilege and credential them.
At Kaiser, we do not.
Kaiser doesn't. Okay.
We have a few that aren't employed, so instead of saying we're really acting as sole proprietors on business.
Okay. Same thing with surgical technicians, or am I only hearing surgical first assist for you, Amy and Danielle?
For Danielle, only first assist. We don't do surgery tech.
At Kaiser, we do not do surgical tests either.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful.
Can I just ask midwives, certified nurse midwives, are you considering them under nurse practitioners?
Well, if they're advanced nurse practitioners, but no, we did not put midwives on here, but now I think, you know, maybe we should readdress
It was addressed in our midwife because there's a difference. Up in Washington, they license them as a certified. Oregon doesn't. They're the nurse practitioner, and they have to actually go out and get the certification. So they just group them all into nurse practitioner. But then Amy's question actually led me to, because I wrote on my list, what about the direct entry midwife? Lay midwife. The original gist was yes, the certified nurse midwife is a nurse practitioner. But how many people really understand that? Since you always see them as certified nurse midwife. So, I mean, they are an advanced nurse practitioner, but they, yeah.
Anybody else thoughts on that?
This is Mary. I couldn't really hear that. So what was...
It's whether or not to include direct entry midwives and was recalling that we grouped basically certified midwives as nurse practitioners.
We do credential and privilege them.
The direct entry?
Yes.
And Providence.
St. Charles also does.
Who was that who also does?
St. Charles. We credential nurse midwives.
Now, there's a difference. So there's a certified nurse midwife and the lay or / direct entry midwife. There's actually, so the certified nurse midwife is your book nurse practitioner, whereas your direct entry midwife is not a nurse practitioner.
Okay.
say Regents does not contract with the direct entry lay midwives in Oregon. We do not.
Okay. All right. We'll take that into consideration. That's another one that, you know, if you do individually, if you're working for the right organization, you get to go through the credentialing process. Yay! Okay. All right. So let's move on from this. The health system definition, I think we'll table that because we're still having discussions with different stakeholders on that piece, but I do have that flagged in here that we'd like to make some changes in that area and define that, and then I have a section on health system under credentialing organization participation. On the next page, on the top of page 3, I'm changing everything to system. And the reason why is we've had some concerns about a solution. Some people are like, oh, this isn't a solution, it's a problem. Okay, that's just like a running joke. But so it's more specific to really we have the program and then we have the program solution and system. I'm already messing it up, but the program system. So I'm just kind of making clarifications in all that language that we're not identifying it as a solution anymore. We're identifying it as a system. Does that make sense to folks? Does that feel better for folks? Okay. And all throughout here, you'll see changes for the statutory authority and the statutes implemented underneath each of the rule sections. And that's because we no longer have to point to the Oregon law because we actually have real statutes to put in there. Okay, and then on page 4, as we start to get into participation, so Healthcare Regulatory Board participation under 409-045-0045, again, changing system. We changed the date in here, but those dates are all still tentative at this point until we get our finalized work plan worked out in the next month or two, so we're just tabling that conversation with you in this meeting. Just pointing that out. A lot of these are date changes. On the top of page 5, this is under credentialing organization participation, so the rule section 0050. Health system shall, and this is what we saw in our previous presentation. For those of you not in the room, talking about health systems, we're still kind of working out how we identify health systems in integrated delivery networks, whether they have health systems and a health plan and how they operate here. But the health system, however we end up really defining it, we'll have to report and maintain some kind of list so that we understand their financially owned affiliations. They'll have to ensure that each of their individual credentialing organizations come into the system separately. It's the idea of that is that practitioners know who they're credentialed with. They may not know the health system owner or the affiliation, so they might just know this certain hospital or whatnot. So we want to make sure that there's an individual credentialing organization affiliation there. And then that they'll be placed in a collective fee tier. And so all those things, are, we're still looking at legal opinion, again, communicating with different stakeholders, so that may be altered.
So a question was raised by Providence, actually, and maybe this is something that will get defined later. So, you know, we know part of this is the providers have to get their information in there. And if we're reporting our tier structure, whatever, it pans out to be. But are we going to have to pay for the practitioners who do not have current materials in the system when we need them? So, like, if we tell you our tier is 5,000, but that provider's not in there, and we've included them because you've been with us for eons, do we have, I mean, in essence, we're being charged for it. I mean, it's...
So I think that's an interesting question because we haven't really defined at what point do we inactivate a practitioner if they're not updating their information. So that's one of the credentialing pieces that we have to work through So I think we can keep that in mind as we're working through how we tally up the practitioner count. I think these rules won't get that specific, but that is something to think about when we're going through our policies on those pieces. So I'm going to make a note of that.
And I think you did answer this one. Annual fees to the credential is going to be an invoice. I'm not talking the practitioners, but you said OHA would invoice the credentialing organization.
Well, so what we would do, I don't know how OHSU would handle it.
No, OHA.
So OHA, yes, we would invoice the different credentialing organizations. But the only question is, as a health system, how do we do that invoicing?
Yeah.
We need to know who all the affiliations are. So yes. I'm just making a note. Okay. We're at 241. Evidently watching the clock. Okay, so it made a clarifying change in 0055 under healthcare practitioner participation. In number two, healthcare practitioners must attest to all credentialing information in the system, but I essentially built that out to the accuracy of all credentialing information and documentation related to the practitioner in the system. And it just makes it a little more clear. I don't know that it's entirely necessary. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Anybody?
For those of us that are part, I think that's what we take our attestation when we're credentialing nowadays, is that they're attesting to the accuracy of the information they've provided. So if we find something during verification time that doesn't match what they told us, we reach out to them and we don't say, you lied, this doesn't match, you lied. I mean, you gave us what you thought was accurate, now we found something that's changed, please update your application.
And you do have a conflict of information policy.
Yeah.
It basically says that in a timeline. It's stipulated to one of the doctors.
Amend.
Melissa, this is Danielle.
Okay.
We're talking about the number two, healthcare practitioners must attest to the accuracy of all credentialing information and documentation related to the practitioner.
Yes.
When you say documentation, are you saying that they're attesting to what they're uploading or what other people are uploading? Because I don't think the providers are going to go in and look at every single document that's uploaded on them. I mean, are they going to be able to see the verifications that people provided? I just want to make sure when you say documentation, what documentation are they attesting to?
No, I think that's a good point. I think that's very unclear. So, in thinking about it that way, I would just take that piece out, but then keep attesting to the accuracy of the information.
Well, you know, in the OPCA...
I would say that the credential information that they're providing, the accuracy of all credential information the practitioner has provided.
Okay, so... then we could actually keep that, but then say all credentialing information and documented provided by the practitioner in the system.
That'd be my suggestion.
Do you want to say accuracy and completeness? Because it might be accurate, but not complete.
What are folks' thoughts on that, saying accuracy and completeness?
There might be a little bit of room for interpretation, depending on the requirements of that particular credentialing entity and what they would consider complete. So,
I'm just thinking if they got recertified by their certifying board,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't report that, the information that's there is still accurate, but they haven't updated you, or maybe they've lost some other malpractice coverage or something, and it's just not completed.
Maybe they just failed to report important details.
Malpractice.
Would Danielle's, or you and Danielle just discussed putting information and documentation that the health care practitioner provided, would provide cover the instance of, let's say, an MPI number that's auto-populated from the Oregon Medical Board file that is technically being attested to by the practitioner, but does that count as them providing it?
That's a very good question, because the application will be pre-populated. So, folks' thoughts on that?
They should be reviewing it, though. If they're going through the
right.
Yeah, that's why it seems
so. So that's why it was like related to the practitioner.
Well, what does the attestation say? Because there's got to be language on the attestation form itself that says, I attest that all of the information is
good.
So why don't we just take that language?
Yeah.
I look at. Do have an OCA in here.
It does say that.
Who knows what page the attestation is on?
Towards the back,
like
12 or 11.
The bottom.
Yeah, that wouldn't help it. It's identifying the certifying that the information in the application is complete, current, correct, and not misleading.
And we've already run through ACPCI, haven't we, for this year to be able to change that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that whatever we put in the system, that's going to be a disclaimer in there. So it's not, technically a field. We're using this as the template, so we can add in those pieces into the system if we want to alter that in any way. But it should go back to the advisory committee anyway.
Because what if it's wrong in there? For some reason, the medical board, the dental board, put some wrong number. Would the practitioner have the ability to overwrite that?
They have complete ownership over that. But it's still, that doesn't help in the definition, though. So if it's related to, that does help in that medical board situation, but not in the situation that it could be somebody else's documentation for verification purposes or something. So,
yeah, submitted is the word, I think, captures it, because to submit your application, you have to test to everything that is pre-populated if it is.
I guess I would expect the practitioner to, if they're going to sign off on something and their office manager will say complete it, because that happens all the time, to at least have reviewed it and made sure that it does apply to them.
Right.
So I don't think that's too much to ask that they be able to attest to that.
Right. And so even if we said submitted by the practitioner or
designee.
Okay, so I'll work with that, and we'll move on, and we'll go back to that in a few weeks. We put language in here to help with employed practitioners, so practitioners at the top of page 6, number 4, practitioners credentialed with one or fewer credentialing organizations are not required to reattest every 120 days. But must update their information when changes occur and no later than 1 month prior to the re-credentialing due date assigned by the credentialing organization in which they may be credentialed. Mouthful.
So, Melissa, this is Catherine at St. Charles. I was just curious about that. Why would they not have to attest?
Well, the idea is that
you want to make sure that we have up-to-date information. And this, in the case with emergency physicians or other employed practitioners, they may only need to be credentialed by one organization. And it's kind of an undue burden or whatever that they come into the system 3 times a year when they only have to be credentialed once every 2 years. So their current responsibility is every 2 years or 3 years, I suppose, they would have to go through the recredentialing process, update their information. But in between that initial application and the recredentialing or the recredentialing cycles, they're not required to do attestations or updates currently. So what's going now, you have to do it 3 times a year, is burdensome for those types of practitioners that are solely with one organization. So the idea is that they do have to at least report any changes, and that's a requirement, and that's a requirement that everyone has. It's a requirement that the licensing boards have. If you change information, you got to report it. Not that they do, but so that's the idea behind that. Does that make sense?
And there's no payers that would check it outside of that 3-year time frame?
We would still be doing continuous monitoring of their expirables and those things. So you can go and check it, and it'll be, you know, up-to-date in verifications, but we're not requiring them to go in and say, did you update your address? Do you have any additional certifications? They should report that as is. The idea of the 120-day attestation was really to make sure we had an updated record within the 180-day time limit for NCQA requirements, and so we had that constant pressure point on the practitioners to make sure their information is up to date.
Got it. Thank you. Melissa, this is Danielle. I have 2 comments or questions. I like that you're giving a loophole because, like, I have ED physicians who are only with us, but they're currently only with one. So say, hypothetically, there are physicians who are only at OHSU, so they only have to go in right before their recredentialing with OHSU.
Right.
But now they want to join Tuolumne. So what's the caveat of now they're applying for a second one?
As soon as they click on the second credentialing organization, they're now back into 120-day attestation territory.
Okay. And then the second thing would be, is 1 month enough time? Because what if they go in there 1 month before their recredentialing is due and they say, oh, I have added other stuff that now has to be verified by the CVO, and we're giving the CVO 30 days to do the verification. So would there be enough time for the CVO to do the stuff and to get it to the COs before the recredentialing deadline for the board meeting?
So that's the question. What about timing? And I think I just randomly plugged that in there. So
I feel like maybe 60 or 90 days would be a better buffer period.
I think that so many organizations start the recredentialing process before one month before it's due. Mm-hmm. I think 1 month is really tight.
Okay. We generally do 4 months. We start requesting applications.
I suggest 3 months. That's just my thought.
Okay.
So there's the language no later than 90 days prior. Is that too much? You can do it prior to, but make sure drop dead. You have to have your information updated for recredentialing. Or
we'll just leave it as when changes exist.
Right. That's what I was going to say. You stop it at when changes occur.
If the providers only practice changes in, you know, for, let's say, a year, that attestation is going to be out of date by the time that they need to be recredentialed. So that credentialing organization is going to have to go to the practitioner and request that they go in and reattest. That's the only piece.
Melissa, are we, when they attest, are we going to be able to download the release page showing that the provider has signed the release? So for privileging purposes and peer reference purposes, we have to sign, we, and the verifications we'll be doing ourselves, we'll need a copy of the release, and we start that process like 3 months in advance. So 3 months in advance, we'd want a current release to be able to utilize for other items we're having to do.
That's the idea. So then, so I'm hearing a lot of 90-day time frame. Okay. So I did hear 1 6 months. That's pretty far in advance, and we should direct your practitioners to go in there 6 months ahead of time. But then we have this rule no later than. Is that how? Is that okay? Okay. Okay, yep.
Melissa?
Yes.
With the certified CBO, why not just stick to the 120-day rule?
What was that, Jen?
With a certified CBO, they have 120 days. Why don't we just stick with that time frame?
Oh, that's your requirement? Change, put your changes in no later than?
Yeah, I mean, because if the, if, you know, with a certified CBO, that's what, that's the rules they're supposed to follow, which then it gives you a certain amount of time to do your job once you get their paperwork.
Okay, so you're certified CBO, and so you're requiring that they come in 120 days prior to re-credentialing.
Well, we're not certified, but that's the certification rule for CBO.
Okay.
The 120 would be on that person.
Well, so we have our 120 day standard, so this is, this is for practitioners that aren't doing that throughout their 2 or 3 year cycle, right? So for just any normal practitioner, is it generally 120 days? Or
it's 180 days if you're not a CBO. So I think she's talking about the turnaround time for MedVersa, that they technically under NCQA have 120 days.
Okay.
Get that file. Our standards are great. Better than that.
Yeah. We have, we have a 30-day window for them. Okay. So we're talking about the practitioners, though, making sure that their information is in the system at a certain amount of time. So if it's in 90 days ahead of time, then the CBO is going to have it processed well before you go in there and pull it.
And Melissa, I guess my thing is when you're saying no later than, really what's the consequence if, like, if they're going to reappoint with us and I go in 90 days beforehand and they haven't reattested it, so I don't have a current release, then I'm just, is this just a cutoff time where I can start bugging the provider to say, hey, you should have went in there and done this by now? Is that what the time frame is supposed to be? Because, I mean, if they do it on day 60, I'm still going to take it. But is it just that now on day 89 I can start bugging the provider like, hey, you haven't done it?
Well, so the intent behind having a date in here is because we're not saying that you have to come in every 120 days. So we have to say something like you have to come in here at some point and update your information prior to your re-credentialing cycle. And so to the extent that that's useful or not, I don't think we can, you know, punish them for not. It's that whole question of what do we do when a practitioner doesn't reattest, right?
And well, and it's also that question of notifying, because in the regular system, it's just notifying the provider. Every 120 days, you need to go and test and reattest. But on this provider, they're getting nothing from the system.
Okay.
So it's on responsibility of that credentialing organization to notify that provider. So I think her question is, when can she do that? Is it 60 days, 30 days, 120 days?
if you're using.
I like going to the 120 that someone suggested because realistically, if the system. Because are we telling the system when the recredentialing cycle is so that the system knows, okay, it's 120 days before and now they're notifying? Because I didn't think we had to notify you guys of dates. So it's just we would have the dates and then we could start bugging them. And if we could start bugging them at 120, we'd probably get them to do it by the 90 days, which is really when we would probably want it to be available.
Right. So we can actually point these rules to prior to your recredentialing period as established by your credentialing organization or something. I'll work with that, and we'll come back to that.
Okay.
We're going to have to end the call. And I just wanted to point out a few things for you. The fee stuff is still in flux right now as to what we're going to require. But I wanted to point out delegation agreements, and that starts at the bottom of page 7 in 0080. What we had talked about as a group in the last few years is that, we have actually public comment passed, and I went by super fast. So anyway, pay attention to that, and we'll come back to that in a few weeks. Do we want to open it up a little bit so people were able to hang on?
To all participants are now in interactive talk mode.
Do any of members of the public have any comments?
We can address the ones that have been emailed or on the webcast in our next meeting, so we'll table those for next time. Okay. Thank you, guys. Thank you a lot. It's always more detailed than you think. But.